think there was really a plan. I mean, I think that they, you know, open the gates and you see the guys running in and they just open fire. And it's unbelievable the amount of shooting. And you know, it lasts for like 7, 8, 9 minutes of just, you know, just shooting, you know, anybody down there, we get shot.
Filmmaker Stanley Nelson describing the violent end to the 1971 Attica prison uprising when New York State troopers tear gassed and shot inmates and the prison guards who had been taken hostage. Nelson has a new documentary looking back at Attica 50 years later. We're going to listen to that coming up. But first, we're going to talk about a few more films opening this weekend with our Friday critics, Tim Grierson and Amy Nicholson. Tim is senior U.S. critic for Screen International and the author of This Is How You Make a Movie. Hi, Tim.
Hello there.
And Amy hosts the podcast Unspooled and reviews films for The New York Times. Hi, Amy.
Hello.
All right. First, let's begin with Last Night in Soho. And here's a clip from the trailer.
Last night, I saw something in my dreams. There was a girl.
And you are?
Sandy.
Well, this sounds fun just in that little bite, Tim, but I know things don't last. The fun doesn't last. It gets creepy, right?
It does get creepy. Yeah, Thomasin McKenzie plays Ellie in the present day, who is a fashion student in London. But what she finds out is that magically she can go back in time and go into the body of a singer in the 1960s named Sandy, played by Anya Taylor-Joy. And at first she's very excited because Ellie has never felt very sort of confident. And Sandy is nothing but confident. She's so elegant and she's part of the swinging 60s scene in London. And she's very excited, but some dark things start to happen and she starts to have these weird visions. And Ellie has to figure out in the present day what happened to Sandy back in the 1960s.
And what did you think?
This movie's directed by Edgar Wright, and as usual, he has a great sort of style, and he really kind of hooks into that swinging 60s feel. His movies are so stylish, but their stories don't necessarily keep pace, and I feel like that's kind of the case with Last Night in Soho. It's a movie where if you know the reference points of what he is paying homage to, the movie can be kind of fun. But I found it so superficial that ultimately I didn't really care about the mystery of sort of Ellie figuring out what happened to Sandy. And as the movie gets kind of more convoluted as it goes along, I found myself less and less engaged. It's fun, but it's very, very slick and superficial.
Amy, Edgar Wright is, of course, of Baby Driver fame, right? So I think I was the only person who actually liked that movie or enjoyed it as it as I was watching it.
I think there's a cult growing. I think that film is building a cult. I really liked it too, honestly.
Well, do you like this one?
I do. I mean, I think this is a movie with really high highs. When it is working, it is just firing on all cylinders. And then it's got a couple clumsy stumbles that I found myself agreeing to forgive. I mean, the central relationship that Tim is describing, I think is captured really incredibly with the camera work here. It's done in camera, these shots of Thomasin and Anya in these dreams together. You see one in the mirror and one in the front. You see the other one in the mirror and the other one in the front. And so you have that central just emotional pull that I really clicked into, and it held my interest in the movie, even though I think it has kind of silly ideas about, you know, how people get pushed around by predatory men. It's a very like men are so bad. And except for this one guy, this one character who's like the film's one nice guy, and he's just this ridiculous construction. So you're rolling your eyes at that, but loving the story between the two women. I think what's strongest about this film is that it really is a film where underneath all of the surface of these women, it's a movie about the limits of nostalgia and how, you know, I have this desire, I'm sure lots of people listening have this desire to step back into a past. And this is a movie about how the past probably isn't as great as it's been portrayed. And what has been portrayed more glamorously than London in the swinging 60s, you know, which was the coolest center of Earth. It's actually the neighborhood where Edgar Wright lives in now. And so this is him really telling a story about his neighborhood. And I think that element of the story is really well done.
Huh. Okay. So make London great again, I guess. all right. So Last Night in Soho is in theaters wherever you want to see it. Next on our list, Antlers, another horror movie. It is October after all. Here's a clip from the trailer.
Can anyone give me an example of a myth or a story they're afraid of?
Oh my gosh, that scared me. Amy, what's going on here?
So that voice you hear is an English teacher in a broke coal mining town where the mine has shut down. And the myth that the film is trying to talk about is the myth of the Wendigo. He's a figure from like Algonquin native folklore. And the essence of the Wendigo, as we're told in kind of the opening credits, is that he is Mother Nature's bodyguard, in effect. And if you're mean to nature, he will fight back. And so this is a film that kind of postures as though it is like an environmental parable, but all of that gets just immediately dropped. It's actually not in the film at all. Really what's happening is that this story is about a 12-year-old boy whose father has a confrontation with the Wendigo early on in the film, and his teacher, Keri Russell, who we just heard, who's realizing that something is wrong with his home life. She has a history of childhood abuse herself, so she sees this connection in him. If all of that sounds really gloomy, it's because this movie is just like relentlessly gloomy. It's the kind of movie where like nobody smiles, nobody acts like they have any reason to wake up in the morning. It's always foggy. You know, it made me feel wet and chilly and just numb. You know, it's really, as much as they try to posture that this is a film with some sort of a subtext, it's really just kind of like a mean old nasty cannibal monster movie. And I feel very sorry for Jesse Plemons, a terrific actor who's just done dirty by playing Keri Russell's brother, who's like this moronic sheriff, just wandering around being like, maybe it's a coyote. And you're like, oh God, what are we doing here?
Tim, did you feel the same way? Like, what are we doing here?
Yeah, this movie is very much a hold my beer in terms of like how depressing and gloomy and despairing it can be. And it's also, Scott Cooper is the director, and it feels in some ways that the movie doesn't want to simply be a gruesome horror movie, which it is. I found myself just kind of miserable the whole time. This movie is set in Oregon. It's a terrible advertisement for Oregon and small coal mining towns in Oregon. Yeah, it's one of those horror movies I wish it would just sort of embrace its ickiness as opposed to saying, no, we're trying to be about things. Horror movies don't have to always be about things. And Antlers was one I wish it was just gruesome and nasty and just sort of like ugly as opposed to pretending it's more than that.
Antlers, if you dare, is in theaters everywhere. Okay, up next, Passing, about a woman who is pretending to be something she is not.
It's easy for a Negro to pass for white. I'm not sure it'd be so simple for a white person to pass for color.
So you haven't ever thought to?
What?
You ever thought of passing?
No, why should I?
All right, Tim, tell us more about this movie.
Okay, so this is set in New York in the late 1920s during the Harlem Renaissance. It stars Tessa Thompson as Irene. She lives in Harlem with her husband, played by Andre Holland. And Tessa, or rather Irene, goes into New York one day, and because she's Black, she is very like careful about being around a predominantly white community that won't necessarily accept her. That's why she's shocked while she's walking down the street to run into an old childhood friend named Claire, played by Ruth Negga, who lives in this white community in New York, and no one seems to notice. Essentially, what Claire is doing is passing for white. This is the directorial debut of a terrific actress, Rebecca Hall. She wrote and directed this. I think this movie is really lovely. I think it's one of the best things that's come out this year. Rebecca Hall, I think, does a really tremendous job of telling a really sort of restrained story about these two women and their sort of shared desires, and also sort of the conflicts that they had in childhood that we're going to slowly learn. And that plays out really beautifully. Rebecca Hall doesn't do a lot of flashy camera movements. There's a lot of static shots in this movie. But as the tension builds and builds and builds in Passing, what happens is that the camera starts to move and things start to happen. And where the movie ultimately goes, I think, is pretty emotionally devastating. I'm a big fan of this film.
It sounds so interesting, bringing up so many interesting, fascinating, provocative issues. And I understand, Amy, this was also shot in black and white, so the visuals really are underscoring what's happening on screen.
Yeah, they really are. They really are. I mean, the lighting in this film, I think, does a lot of work, kind of lightening and darkening the women's face so that they pop out more in different settings and sort of building a contrast between, you know, how they're presenting, how they're feeling, how they're blending in. I mean, I really can't say enough what a great debut this is by Rebecca Hall, who like directed and wrote the script. You know, the original novel that this is based on by Nella Larsen was written in 1929. and Rebecca's approach to it. You know, it's a fairly thin novel. In the way she builds it out, I feel like is so respectful to the time period without feeling like stiff or period piecey. You know, it feels mm-hmm. like you get inside the mindset of what it was like to be a woman in the 1920s. It's about, I think, people more than gigantic statements on, you know, racial politics at the time, and that focus on people and like the really dramatic, quiet spoken inner lives of these women is just absolutely fantastic. I feel like this is the movie we're going to be talking about now through the Oscars.
Passing in theaters and on Netflix. Finally, on our list, we have The Souvenir Part 2, and here's a bit from the trailer.
What did you feel when Anthony died?
I was very concerned for you.
No, not what I felt. What did you feel?
I never felt through you.
I just wanted to ask you a few questions about Anthony.
Make a memorial for him.
Okay, Amy, for those who didn't see The Souvenir Part 1, which probably most people didn't because it was an art house flick, tell us a little bit about this.
Gladly. I mean, first, can I just say I love the audacity of the director, Joanna Hogg, making a sequel to an indie art house movie that almost nobody saw and calling it The Souvenir Part 2, like it's a Nightmare on Elm Street movie. I love that so much. Just being like, yes. I can tell the story in my first movie about like a young artist, a wannabe filmmaker who's like going to film school and she's in this relationship with this mysterious man and it doesn't end well. And you know what? I can keep going and I can tell more stories about this girl because I find her really interesting.
Because it's basically herself, right?
Yeah. You do sense it's a little bit of like biography, you know, Joanna Hogg being a female filmmaker herself and this film being about a female filmmaker played by Honor Swinton Byrne. This film is about this character, Julie, grappling with what happened in the relationship that got destroyed in the first film and trying to figure out how she can put it into art. I wasn't the biggest fan of the first Souvenir, and I feel like this film really feels the absence of the character, Tom Burke, who played her boyfriend. He just had this really crazy charisma that this film lacks. But I feel like what Joanna Hogg does at every turn is trying to make a film about a vague person who can't speak her mind and is trying to do it through her art, but is not doing it through her art very well. I guess what I would say is this movie feels not so much like a croissant. It feels like a lumpy scone of ideas. And that's kind of what it wants to be. It wants to be sort of like a casual scone that also is called The Souvenir Part 2, which I will be chuckling about forever. I think it's just hilarious.
I myself love to eat a scone. So I'm okay with that. Tim, what did you think?
As a fellow scone fan, yes, I also like Souvenir Part 2. The first Souvenir was in my top 10 that year. I was a big fan of it. I don't love this one as much for the reason that Amy says. I miss Tom Burke as well. But in some ways, I think what makes the Souvenir Part 2 is interesting is that there is this idea of the growing pains of young filmmakers trying to kind of figure out their voices. I will say, though, that what I do like is Tilda Swinton, who is Honor Swinton Byrne's real-life mother and plays her mother in the movie, just like she did in the first Souvenir. And she is especially good. I think we sometimes can think of Tilda Swinton as playing these really sort of outrageous characters and her really kind of going over the top in her performances. And that can be really fun. But this is the Tilda Swinton that's much more reserved. And this is a concerned mother who knows that her daughter is struggling and doesn't know exactly how to help her. It's a much more sort of stripped down performance from Tilda Swinton, but it's really, really lovely.
All right, that is The Souvenir Part 2, which you can only see in theaters, which I assume do not serve scones, but they should though. That would be a good addition.
We should look into that. I think there's a market for that.
If you put it in your pocket, I won't tell anybody.
Amy Nicholson hosts the podcast Unspooled and reviews movies for the New York Times. And Tim Grierson is senior U.S. critic for Screen International and author of the book, This Is How You Make a Movie. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, we'll talk about a new documentary. It's about the uprising at Attica in 1971, when prisoners took guards hostage for 5 days to demand more humane conditions.
You know, if we have to be in prison, we just want to be able to live here with dignity and these basic human rights that we should expect as human beings.
My conversation with filmmakers Tracy Curry and Stanley Nelson next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. 50 years ago, at the maximum security state prison Attica in upstate New York, more than 1,000 inmates overwhelmed dozens of guards and civilian prison workers and took control of the prison.
We start hearing these sirens going off. I said, what the hell is this?
And all of a sudden, I seen the metal shop door open, and I seen guys come running in there with great big pipes and knives.
They killed one guard and took the rest hostage. The prisoners demanded better treatment and living conditions. Days of back and forth negotiations yielded no resolution. So New York's governor, Nelson Rockefeller, ordered state troopers to retake the prison.
We ain't got no guns to shoot back. You know what it is to shoot somebody and they can't shoot back? Lord have mercy.
The violence that followed left 29 inmates dead and 10 of the hostages, all of whom were killed by law enforcement. A new documentary looks back at the biggest prison uprising in U.S. history. It's called Attica, and it's directed by filmmakers Stanley Nelson and Tracy Curry. And they're both with me now. Welcome to Press Play.
Thanks, Madeline.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Great to have you. Okay, so your film drops us immediately into the moment the uprising began, but I want to go back to before it happened to figure out what led up to this. And I want to begin by playing a clip of tape with two voices. The first is former Attica prisoner Arthur Harrison, and then the second is an attorney named Joe Heath describing the conditions inside the prison.
A roll of toilet paper would have to last you a month. You have to be a magician or tear up papers out of, you know, the books and stuff like that to wipe your behind and stuff like that. Basic things like toothpaste, a change of sheets more than once a month, clothes being clean, personal hygiene things, being treated like human beings.
There was no religious freedom, particularly for the burgeoning Muslim movement. They were denied the right to worship. They were fed pork because the prison also had a farm where they raised pigs, so that's what you got.
Stanley, tell me more about what it was like inside Attica. This prison was really considered the end of the line, the worst place anyone could be sent to. What were the conditions like leading up to the takeover of the prison?
Yeah, I think one of the things first we have to note is that, you know, Attica was about 250 miles from New York City, so it was in really far upstate in rural America. It was hard to get to, hard for you to have visitors. The guards were especially cruel. The guards were not trained as guards. It was just a job. They came from what was almost an all-white town in Attica. There were no black or brown guards in Attica. And as Arthur Harrison says later, you know, that
fear. They ran the prison with fear, being scared of them. Were their means of running the prison.
And kind of refused to talk to the prisoners at all.
They'd give you this face, don't talk to me. And it was like that, don't talk to me.
They would hit their sticks on the wall once if they wanted you to go, and then twice if they wanted you to stop.
And this is a metal tip stick, and it rings out, and it bop, and you walk. And then when they want you to stop, they say bop, bop.
That was their communication.
That was how the prison was run.
Mm. And Tracy, what about the racial breakdown inside the prison? I mean, we have heard about prisons today being divided along racial lines. Was that the case back then?
Yeah, yes, absolutely, Madeline. I mean, you had a group of primarily Black and Puerto Rican, some white prisoners that mostly came from downstate. So New York City, Buffalo and Rochester, but primarily a population of urban folks that, as you hear someone in the film, to the people who lived in Attica Village and that worked there were may as well have been aliens. And so I think, you know, that divide certainly was part of the kindling that ultimately led to the rebellion that happened.
Yeah. And you spoke with several of the spouses and children of some of the guards, and it's not like they didn't know that this kindling was getting drier and drier. And they knew that there were really bad tensions inside the prison. Tensions, of course, they were contributing to, but they were also afraid of, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you hear in the film, the prisoners talk about that buildup of tensions, but you also hear the families of the guards and the children say, my dad came home every day talking about how he could feel it. It was palpable.
Yeah. Well, let's play a clip of what you're talking about. Here is Dee Quinn Miller. She's the daughter of the guard, William Quinn, who was killed, and Don Mitzel. He's the son of the guard, Al Mitzel.
Things were getting worse. And so they had a meeting with the administration, and the administration essentially dismissed their concerns and said, everybody back to work. However, we think maybe it's a good idea if you left your personal belongings at home, like wedding rings, wallets, etc. So my father absolutely knew that something was going on.
I having breakfast with him, and he was talking to me, and I knew he was nervous, but he said, something's going to happen. He said, I just don't know what or when.
All right, so Stanley, the when was September 8th, 1971. What was the animating incident, if you will? What was the match that ignited this kindling?
Superficially, it was a fight that happened during the day among some inmates, and they were promised that no retaliation would happen by the guards for fighting, but then the guards came and took the inmates out of the cells and took them to the box, as it was called, where, you know, anything could happen, beatings, whatever. But really, you know, it was, as Tracy said, there were tensions mounting all the time.
Okay, so they managed to get the keys from a guard and unlock the cells and let some of the inmates out. And out of a population of, what, more than 2,000 inmates, half decide to gather into the central part of the prison. Tracy, can you describe where they gathered, this place that they called Times Square?
So the way that Times Square plays into it is that Attica had what was at the time that it was built, a very unique kind of layout. I think it was like the early of 20th century. There had actually been a lot of prison uprisings and I think some escapes. And so the idea was to design a prison that was meant to be escape proof and riot proof. And the way they did that was that, as you can see in the aerial shots of the prison, is they essentially took the old model, which was sort of one big yard in the center of the prison, and they divided it into this grid of four smaller yards, A yard, B yard, C yard, and D yard. With Times Square being at the intersection of those. And there was a series of sort of gates that would allow people to kind of pass through that was controlled by one guard that had keys there. So originally, when the rebellion first happened, the prisoners had managed to take over several parts of the prison. Each side of that square was a different prison block, and they took over a few of those. And so there was some initial resistance from guards and law enforcement that essentially sort of forced the prisoners back into this one corner of the prison, and that was DR'd. And so that's how they all sort of ended up there. There just came to be this understanding in the midst of the rebellion, as they all kind of were coalescing around one place, that DR'd was kind of the place to be. And that's the area that they took over and were able to hold on to for that time.
Okay, so this is the Thursday of this period, the first day. And then how do they establish order, like who was in charge and how they were going to organize themselves?
Well, as you see in the film, there was absolute chaos. Originally, I think, one of the people compares it to sort of the Wild Wild West, and, you know, every man is an island unto himself. But I think very quickly, there were some prisoners that realized that they had a very unique opportunity to kind of push for some of the changes that they had been wanting to see. And incidentally, had actually appealed in a petition to the prison prior to this to happen, and nothing happened. And like Stanley mentioned earlier, there were a lot of folks at Attica who had been a part of political movements outside the prison or otherwise became radicalized inside the prison, people who were religious leaders. And so some of those folks kind of took it upon themselves to say, okay, listen, we need to kind of get this together and, you know, let's get organized. You had people that recognized that maybe we're going to be out here for a few days. So as you see in the film, there were folks in Vietnam who understood sort of how to, you know, establish some sort of livable conditions with the trenches and the tents. And so they, what is very remarkable is that they were able to, in a short time after the initial chaos, come up with this sort of city within the prison with its own, you know, democratic institutions. And so they voted And they made sure to have representation amongst the leadership from the different racial groups, the different political groups, the different religious groups, different blocks within the prison. And so I think that's one of the most sort of remarkable things about the story is how quickly the prisoners were able to sort of find some order out of the original chaos.
Right. And so then they also had the guards as hostages, and they didn't attack the guards or beat them up. With the exception of the one guard who did die, William Quinn. And another interesting part was they basically, some of them did want to exact revenge on these guards, but the Muslim prisoners were the ones who guarded them because they didn't believe in violence.
Our understanding of Islam was that you don't harm a captive. Therefore, it was decided to allow the Muslim brothers to look out for them.
I was so mad at them for not letting us get to the police because I wanted to put my hands. I wanted to get one or two of them and really f*** them up. These are the same police that was talking down to me. So I said, yeah, now what do you think about me now? Yeah, yeah. And the good thing that them Muslims was there because a lot of them police would have been hurt, really hurt.
Yeah, just to clarify a little bit, there were some guards mm-hmm. that sort of experienced some, you know, some injuries initially. But again, once they kind of got into the yard and realized the opportunity they had with the hostages, just strategically, it just did not make sense to harm these people if this is your leverage to kind of exact some of the changes that you're trying to get. And it kind of naturally fell to the Muslims, which, you know, as part of their religious beliefs was you do not harm a defenseless person, you do not harm a hostage. And so that sort of became their responsibility. And then from then on out, I think, you know, they were very proud of the fact that, you know, we are not going to treat them the way that they treat us. And so, you know, they took great care to make sure that none of the hostages were harmed, made sure that they were fed, made sure that they had mattresses to sleep on. So it was, I think, a point of pride for them that they were not going to, you know, do the same harm to these hostages that they say had been done to them as prisoners inside the facility.
Right. Interesting, because we heard earlier about how poorly the Muslim inmates had been treated with regards to, for instance, their food. They were served a lot of pork.
Yeah, the prisoners were fed on 21 cents a meal, 63 cents a day. I think also, you know, we should note that the guard who died was injured severely at the taking of the prison on the first day, but he did not pass away until the third day. And that really was a change in the whole attitude, makeup, result of what happened in the prison.
Well, let's get to that in a moment, but I want you to set up the scene inside. And I'm also wondering, Stanley, how you got the footage, because there was some remarkable footage of that early day, the first day, the second day, of them setting up the camp, setting up the latrines and the little tents that they slept in, and just the general sense of jubilation that the prisoners were experiencing on that first day.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we knew that there was footage out there, but we didn't have any idea the amount of footage that was out there. You know, we just looked every possible place we could, you know, the networks were ABC, CBS, NBC, and PBS kind of at that time. But also the Attica is probably closest to Buffalo. So we, you know, went to the Buffalo stations.
So that footage came from newscasters at the time, from journalists at the time who were allowed in to see what was happening?
Yeah, I mean, one of the most remarkable things about Attica and one of the real turning points was that the inmates realized early on that they wanted the media to come in. They thought that the media would give them a certain amount of protection, and they wanted the media to come in and film. And so they invited the media in. And so early on, cameras came in and filmed a lot of what was going on. And it's just, you know, incredible footage, you know, not only of them setting up tents and food and digging the latrines, but also as the days progressed of the negotiations and the inmates making speeches.
Well, we have a clip of one of those inmates on tape at the time. And as you say, the prisoners realized that they now had a voice to the world through the news media. And here he is talking about a few of their demands.
We want to be treated as human beings. We will be treated as human beings. We have come to the conclusion, after close study, after much suffering, after much consideration, that if we cannot live as people,
then we will at least try to die like men.
If you people do not understand, if you people do not stick with us, we are dead.
I appeal, beseech you all to stand with us. Walk with us. Die with us if necessary. You are all the people. Power to you and all the people.
And Tracy, what did they want? What were they demanding?
Yeah, so there was some back and forth over the course of the negotiations as they kind of coalesced around one final list. But ultimately, the things that they were asking for were sort of basic human rights issues, religious freedom, you know, the basic things like the toilet paper and the shower. They were asking for some sort of systemic things like changes in the parole system. They were asking for an end to some of the violence and the brutality that they were experiencing in the prison. I mean, if you look at the list, it was, you know, the kinds of things that you and I take for granted every day. And I think it's important to know that because the way that it got covered at the time spent a lot of time on the sort of more sensational aspects of what they were asking for, like, you know, this plane out of the prison, which we kind of talk about in the film. But I think we make it clear that this was sort of a pie in the sky kind of, you know, if we've gotten all these other things and we've gotten the media and these powerful people coming in, why not? But ultimately, that really wasn't the heart and the essence of what it is they were asking for. It really was just to, you know, if we have to be in prison, we just want to be able to live here with dignity and these basic human rights that we should expect as human beings in this system.
And so there were, aside from the media, there were a bunch of high profile negotiators there who were sent in to act as intermediaries, I guess. And that included the civil rights attorney, William Kunstler, who was involved in the Chicago 7 trial, and also New York Times columnist Tom Wicker, the head of the Amsterdam News. So big names, big people who were in there and actually talking to the inmates. And Stanley, were they sympathetic to their side?
Yeah, I mean, they were called the Observer Committee, and they were sympathetic to the prisoners. They were asked, they were brought in by the prisoners. The prisoners, in many ways, because they had the hostages, had a certain amount of control, and they asked that certain people be brought in. And they had a list, and they chose the people that they wanted to bring in, many of them because they had shown that they were in favor of prisoner rights beforehand. So they were called the Observer Committee, but they really were negotiators and trying to negotiate some kind of settlement and some kind of peaceful settlement for this situation.
So it looked tentatively positive for them until, as you mentioned, one of the officers, corrections officers, died of his wounds that he suffered a few days before, William Quinn. And then everything changed. So what was the reaction on the outside on the part of the head of the prison and on the part of law enforcement and the governor when they found out that William Quinn died?
Well, I think that, you know, as far as law enforcement and the people that had gathered outside, there had already been building tensions because unfortunately there were a lot of rumors flying around, some of which got reported in the media, that the hostages were being tortured, that people were being castrated, that someone had been pushed off a balcony. So you already have these simmering and growing tensions. And so you introduce into that now that, you know, one of the guards, their brother in arms for the people in the village, you know, a member of their community has been killed. And all of a sudden that sort of simmering tension builds up into a rage. And I think on the part of the state, it then just becomes untenable that we continue negotiating with these prisoners and certainly not to offer them the amnesty, which ultimately became sort of the defining issue as far as the prisoners were concerned after William Quinn died.
Right. This means one thing to offer amnesty for the general taking of the prison, but another thing entirely when there's a death of someone involved, harder to do.
Yeah.
And I think that one of the things also was the mood inside, because many of the people on the Observers Committee were lawyers or politicians, and even the inmates, they understood that once Billy Quinn died, the whole situation had changed. So the mood just changed from one of positiveness to everybody understood, as Hermann Schwarz says in the film, that you don't get amnesty for a murder.
Mm. I guess, what was the thought, though? Did they think that they were going to return to a prison that was totally changed had this death of Quinn not happened? Were they thinking that everyone would change and it'd be more sort of kumbaya? I mean, as we discussed, it was a pretty brutal place to begin with. So what were they really thinking would change?
I think they were thinking that as Tracy mentioned, you know, that they would get the small changes, more toilet paper, more showers, maybe, you know, better visiting hours. But they knew that there would be probably some kind of retaliation by the guards. But they would take that if they could get those changes that ultimately would make their lives a little better.
So the governor at the time, Nelson Rockefeller, he could have come in and met with them and really calmed things down, but he chose not to. And he was in conversation with President Nixon at the time, who was really into law and order. And that was his campaign theme, of course. And same with Rockefeller, the author of the Rockefeller drug laws, of course. And you have some really great footage or audio recordings, because Nixon taped almost every conversation he had in the White House, but of the two talking about this. And it's really remarkable to hear how candid Rockefeller is in saying that he basically has no intention of coming in there and trying to sort of calm things down.
Back them up. We're not going to have any we just cannot tolerate this kind of anarchy.
They were putting the pressure yesterday on me all day to go up there. Ended up, because everything else had failed. And
did you go?
Of course not.
No, I wasn't. Of course not.
But I had to talk to these guys, Wicker and all these people on the phone, you know.
Yeah.
And I said, look, I go up there. We can't give amnesty. The next thing is, well, we'll let them go if you'll just come into the courtyard.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
In front of all the men.
Well, did Wicker, was he recommending amnesty?
Oh, yes.
Oh, God.
Was that the sort of final nail in the coffin, if you will?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the last ditch effort was to try to get Rockefeller to come. And, you know, the Observer Committee were some high powered people, you know, Senator Dunn and Clarence Jones, who was publisher of the Amsterdam News. And you know, they personally called Rockefeller together and just begged him to come and begged him, you know, said to him that, you know, you don't have to go inside the prison. You know, just come and stand on the outside in the parking lot and just show your concern that the prisoners, you know, are tired and hungry, and maybe we can help find a peaceful solution to this thing. But Rockefeller refused even to do that. And I think that at that point, yeah, that was the last-ditch effort to try to get a peaceful settlement. And when he refused, that was the nail in the coffin, because Russell Oswald, the prison commissioner, had already said that he was going to go in. And now this was the last-ditch effort to try to stop that.
So they decide to go in, and this is on Monday, so 5 days later. And I'm just going to play a clip here of former inmates you talked to in your movie describing what happened.
That gas knocked me down. I don't know what that was. And it had me so weak I could not move. And they got on the microphone. Everybody in D Block Yard, put your hands in the air, and you will not be harmed.
Go to the nearest state police officer, and you will not be harmed.
You will not be harmed.
You will not be harmed.
You will not be harmed. But that was bullshit.
Wow. So then there's a hail of gunfire. And Tracy, is it just chaos, just bullets flying everywhere?
Yeah. I mean, I think what we really tried to do in that scene is give you a sense of what the people in that yard experienced, this orgy of violence and brutality, and what it is to kind of be in the middle of that as it happens. I mean, I think you kind of see and understand from the film just how harrowing and traumatic and brutal that whole moment was for everybody that was there.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that we have to understand is first they sent down all this gas, you know, which knocked people out and knocked people down. But you couldn't see, you know, so there was smoke everywhere. So they couldn't even see. They just were shooting randomly, you know, down. And I mean, and it's unbelievable the amount of shooting. And, you know, it lasts for like 7, 8, 9 minutes of just, you know, just shooting, you know, into the fog, into the smoke. Anybody down there would get shot. There was no plan. There was just a need to show, you know, force, brute force, and to establish what they call law and order.
So they just said to the guards, go in there and start shooting randomly? Is that what you mean by no plan?
I mean, Tracy, you may know more than me, but I don't think there was really a plan. I mean, I think that they, you know, open the gates and you see the guys running in, and they just open fire.
Yeah, I mean, I think there had been, you know, some conversation about how it was supposed to unfold. This many are going to come out of the catwalks and shoot here, and these are going to come in this entrance, and this is going to happen. But again, Madeline, these people had been waiting outside of the prison, hearing all these horrible stories, getting angrier and angrier, more and more emotional. We know, as we see in the film, that there was some racial animus there. And these were the state troopers. So these are the people that, you know, pull you over on the highway and give you a traffic ticket. This is not, as we saw, who came in as the medical relief, the National Guard, who in many ways are, because Kent State had happened, had, you know, understood the nature, why it was necessary to kind of not overdo it, and who understood strategically how to put down a riot. That's not who this was. And so in some ways, it almost seems inevitable. When you put all of those things together, that it would have happened like this. What do you expect after 4 days of these people hearing that these people are being tortured, there's some racial animus, and then you put a gun in that person's hand, and even if there is a plan, what do you think is going to happen when you then send that person to the into the prison and tell them to shoot?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, you know, right afterwards, we see the people, the law enforcement that took over the prison, you know, laughing and joking and yelling white power.
White power! White power! White power! White power!
It's very, the footage is very stark, and, you know, it's right there in front of you.
Some of the men that you interview, they seem to have lasting physical damage. I think one man has a problem with his eye. Was that from being shot?
Yeah. So during the interviews, there were several of them that sort of showed me the scars, the wounds. Some of them still carry bullet fragments from that day in their bodies to this day. So yeah, so there have been physical and emotional lasting scars, not only for the prisoners, but also for the surviving families of the guards that died as well.
Right. So it wasn't just a hail of gunfire. So the violence didn't stop there. Then they tortured them, the people who weren't killed, and had them undergo some real humiliation.
We're naked in the middle of the yard. Guards going around with like baby bats. They were shoving them up guys' asses. I'm laying here and I'm hoping they don't come my way.
They had guards on both sides, and they would be hitting you as you were running through, beating you with hoses and batons and whatever they had in their hands.
I'm ducking, trying to get through, protecting my head. My shoulders got hit all on my arms, my elbows, my knees. It still hurt.
Beating you after making you run through the gauntlet where they took all the glass out the windows and put in the middle of the floor. So you had to run through glass with bare feet.
Nobody came out of that yard without having to pick glass out of your feet for weeks. Couldn't walk. Nobody could walk anymore. But we had to run, because if you didn't run, they just kept beating you with these clubs.
That is the most harrowing part of your documentary, those images. And I'm just wondering, because you do see dead bodies, you see photographs of naked men. They made the prisoners strip naked, which is really reminiscent of, as one of your people says in the documentary, of images of slaves being sold. And so I'm wondering about those images, how you got them, and if you debated whether showing them would be too horrific for the viewer.
Yeah, I mean, we thought a lot about the images, and you know, we didn't want to go too far. We didn't want to feel like the viewer to feel like, you know, that we were overdoing it, but we felt that it was really important to show, you know, you couldn't feel it unless you see it. And so we thought it was really important. And we spent a lot of time, you know, are we going too far? Are we going far enough? But we thought the images are powerful. And, you know, one of the most interesting things is that it seems to affect the audience the most, you know, even more than the actual orgy, as Tracy said, you know, the orgy of killing. It's really the torture that goes on afterwards. And those images that really affect people. So, you know, we wanted you to be affected. I think to get what happened at Attica, you have to be affected like the former prisoners are affected.
Right. And so in that orgy of violence, the hostages themselves were killed, right? I mean, so they were killed by so-called friendly fire.
Yeah. I mean, I think it really sort of exposes the lie, right? That this was necessary to save the lives of the hostages rather than to reaffirm the power of the state. When you see that ultimately it was 10 of the hostages that were in fact killed by the state, these are their own employees. But the story at the time was that this is what was necessary. There must be law and order. We must save these people. And ultimately you see that the actions of the state kind of negate all of those claims as to why it had to happen the way it did.
You know, I just kept thinking how sad an end to the 60s this incident was, 1971, really. And the last few years of the 60s, of course, it were incredibly violent, what with the various assassinations. However, just to see this, it just, I don't know, just struck me as a really tragic end to the turmoil and the protests and the, sure, a lot of gains were made in the 60s, but there was so much violence and so much racial strife, and that this in 1971 seemed to be like the final, like, I don't know, boot of authority clamping down on a decade of protest.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting that you say that because, you know, one of the things that I've thought about a lot is that this was kind of the end of the 60s. And it really was. It was very different from the 60s. It was just a show of real force, and that no, we don't have to negotiate. We don't have to take it anymore. There's a different way of doing things. And, you know, law and order is going to rule the day.
And the state never apologized to the relatives, the survivors of either the guards or of the prisoners, right?
No, never. No. And in fact, what you see in the sort of afterword of the film is that, you know, the prisoners, after this decades long legal fight, ultimately get a settlement. The families of the guards did not have that option because in agreeing to sign the workmen's comp checks of their dead husbands and fathers and whatnot, the widows of the guards who were killed forfeited their right to sue the state for damages. And so essentially what happened was after the prisoners received their settlement, the families organized and basically did a public campaign to shame the state of New York into giving them that settlement. And there were a few things that they asked for, one of which was an official apology from the state, which never came to this day.
So what is Attica like now? Have there been prison reforms in the wake of all this?
So immediately after the rebellion in 1971, there were some small changes at Attica Prison. You know, I think some of the dividers that kept people separated from their visitors came down. Maybe the food got a little better. There were, you know, things here and there. But as we know, and as you mentioned earlier, Madeline Rockefeller, before becoming vice president, goes on to pass the Rockefeller drug laws, which then become the blueprint for these laws all around the country. Which fuel mass incarceration and land us in the situation where we're in today, where the United States has the largest prison population in the world. So I think there are certain things that you probably could point to and say, this is better than that. There's some educational programs, there's this, there's that. But when we kind of talk about, you know, this story and the consequences writ large, I think it's hard to kind of point to anything and say that there has been any really substantive improvement in the carceral system.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today, and thank you for your really important, riveting documentary.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Tracy Curry and Stanley Nelson. Their new documentary is called Attica. It debuts today at the Lemley in Santa Monica, and it'll premiere next Saturday, November 6th at 9 o'clock on Showtime. Well, that does it for this week on Press Play. Our producers are Angie Perrin, Bennett Purser, Kaylee Wells, Anna Buss, Nisha Venkat, and Brian Hardzinski. Brian produced my interview with the directors of Attica. Michelle Aloy is our line editor. Sarah Sweeney is our managing producer. Amy Ta is our digital editor. Our technical directors are Mario Saavedra and Phil Richards. Lorenzo Ponce de Leon also engineered this week. Don't forget, you can download and subscribe to our podcast. Get it wherever you get your podcasts or at KCRW.com/pressplay. I'm Madeline Brandt. Have a fantastic weekend. I'll see you on Monday.